Blog Talk Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, and welcome to the Elevated Places Network presents A Time for Justice. My name is Sister Pamela Muhammad, and I am your host. I'm an attorney, and I am the host in this roundtable discussion of Legal Minds on A Time for Justice. On our show, we discuss this country's centuries-long failure to apply, uphold, and enforce the laws, and the overall failure of the legal system to give justice and the negative impacts that these failures have had on Black people and their Black families. Ultimately, we want fair dealing. We want justice under the law, but all too often, this is not what we see. Our guest tonight will not make those excuses for racist conduct often seen, which are really just distractions from the truth. And the truth is the path to justice and equal protection. So let's talk about just, fair, and equitable solutions, which are in the best interest of the people. Let's remove the distractions. So tonight's topic is really I think it's an interesting topic. It's a historical topic. We're going to talk about Dred Scott and how the legal system denies citizenship rights to our people and Black people, poor people. Dred Scott is a case that we're going to discuss, and we're going to talk about how that Supreme Court ruling and the precedents still stands today, and it's very, very important. We've got two magnificent guests. We've got two Black lawyers. One of them we hear from pretty often, and one is not as often, but promises to bring a lot of legal analysis. And I'm going to go ahead by opening up the mic for our brother, Athil Muhammad, who is one of our brothers in the nation, born and raised in Brooklyn, New York, graduate of the Texas Thurgood Marshall School of Law. He's licensed in the state of Texas, federal court systems, and he's been involved in litigation with federal death penalty cases, police misconduct, and civil rights violations. So I'm going to go ahead and open up Brother Athil's mic and welcome him to the show tonight. As-salamu alaykum, Brother Athil.
Wa alaykum salam, ma'am, and to the audience. And thank you, as always, thank you very much for having me. And hopefully there might be one or two things we have to say that will, you know, pique someone's curiosity and further our, you know, struggle for liberation.
That's right. Yes, sir. And you have to forgive me. I gave the short version of your bio today. You do so much more. And as we go on in this conversation, we really want you to tell the listeners some of what you do on a day-to-day basis as an attorney. I'm going to open up the mic for another attorney who by the name of Gerald T. Christmas. Gerald is a community activist and veteran litigator with over 20 years experience focusing on criminal defense, personal injury, civil rights litigation. Attorney Christmas, he has an understanding of criminal justice system. He's worked with juveniles, adults, and adults, excuse me, in the criminal justice system. Attorney Christmas is also a astute politician running for St. Louis Circuit Attorney, working on local political campaigns. Attorney Christmas assisted in the election of Claire McCaskill, who was in the United States Senate, and he actually worked in D.C. for 3 years. Attorney Christmas is a graduate of Texas Southern, also Texas Southern University, Thurgood Marshall School of Law, and he has deep ties in the St. Louis community. So I'm going to go ahead and open up Attorney Christmas. I do want to mention, though, because this is a family show, we support black families. Attorney Christmas, he has a wife and 4 daughters, and I think that's such a, just one of our greatest accomplishments sometimes as professionals is our families and what we bring to our communities. So I wanted to open up Attorney Christmas's mic. Assalamu alaikum, Attorney Christmas.
Wa alaikum salam, Sister Pam. Thank you for having me. And it's always great to be on here with another TSU alum from Thurgood Marshall School of Law. That makes it even better.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And I wanted to say, because I did shorten Brother Athil's resume tonight, his bite, but he joins us a lot, and he has a vast amount of activities he does as well. But the part I wanted to add was, now, Attorney Athil Muhammad adds Omega Psi Phi fraternity to his resume, and you, our brother Christmas, is a fine member of Phi Beta Sigma Fraternity, Inc. So I just kind of wanted to say those two things. Yeah, and that's really important, because one of our topics as lawyers tonight is how we do have to help our people in the community. Lawyers have the role of being community connectors. Lawyers have the role of making sure that the information gets into the community of how this legal system works, but also being problem solvers and also being social engineers. So really coming out into the community and making sure that we are helping our people in any way that we can, in these nonprofits, in these bar associations. Of course, we work in the Nation of Islam, but this is a very important job of the attorney as well. So I wanted to say that. But I wanted to go ahead and get started with our topic, because this is really a huge topic when we talk about Dred Scott. And we're going to tell the listeners about Dred Scott, but I wanted to put it in the context of, there's a murder trial right now for the murder of our brother Ahmaud Arbery. And brother Ahmaud Arbery, as we all know, was murdered in Georgia. And the young man was killed by 3 white men. And as this case is just starting, we're understanding that the makeup of the jury is nearly all white. There's a nearly all white jury to hear the murder trial of this jogger, our brother, Ahmaud Arbery. And so the dismissal of the black jurors from the panel, and hear our brother's murder trial where the accused are 3 white men, Travis McMichaels, another McMichaels, and someone by the last name of Brian. These 3 white men, they trailed our brother, followed him in a truck while he was jogging. And then Travis opened fire and killed our brother with a 12-gauge shotgun. And this other Brian person, he filmed the whole thing. And so their story, as this article says, they contend that they mistook our brother Arbery as being a burglar. And so this is where I think Dred Scott really comes in for so many reasons, because, again, we know that that's a monumental case that really defines that black people don't have citizenship rights in accordance with what the Supreme Court of that time determined, and no rights that a white man actually had to respect. And so we just see this in so many facets of this trial. I just wanted to also put out there was an article on the front page of The Final Call, and that was the November 9th, 2021, entitled 59 Shots and a Cover-Up. Because, again, part of the legacy of black people in America is that we live in a racist society, but the racism is now they try to lie and be deceptive as to what the true motives. But, again, we're going to go back to Dred Scott because we know what the true motive is. Black man has no rights that a white man is bound to respect. So this young man, Jamarian Rashad Robinson, another brother who was killed in East Point, Georgia, which is a suburb of Atlanta. But as this young man, and this is in an article written by brother Nabah Muhammad and Michael Muhammad, this 26-year-old young man, his body included 76 exit wounds, and he was shot 59 times. And this killing happened in 2016, and Miss Monteria Robinson, who is Jamaria's mother, she would not let it go. And so she has fought this case for 5 years, trying to get finally some indictments. So this is another case that is just beginning, and I believe reflects, you know, what we're saying. Our topic is that Dred Scott and the black man's rights are not respected in this country. And again, we want to talk about how the law shows that. So I want to go ahead and open up the mic for you all, because we're going to talk about the Dred Scott decision. But, you know, any comments? You all are lawyers, practitioners. You do civil lawsuits where you're seeking damages for these, you know, injuries and death. But you also do criminal cases where you're very familiar with how jury selections work and the deception that goes on that in these cases. So anybody want to just open up this discussion with any comments at this time? And if I could, somebody has some background in the background noise. I don't know if you could mute the mic when you're not speaking. That's all. Thank you. Yes, so Attorney Athil Muhammad, I'm going to go ahead and open up with you. And I want, you know, please give us some comments as to, you know, what you've heard and how this is something you see in your practice, or just any, you know, responses to what we're seeing.
Sure. Well, you know, it's always been my contention, and hopefully it'll be my contention until, you know, I take my last breath, that, you know, the jury procedure is not really a selection. You don't select a jury. You actually, you know, supposedly then qualify persons, but you know, persons are not selected, you know, in truth, you know. So let's, you know, dispel that myth. You know, that, you know, persons from the jury pool of veneer, they come, they, you know, it's a numbers game, for lack of a better term. But you're not necessarily selected. It's not as if, you know, you could say, okay, well, I want this person, I want that person, I want this person. In other words, they're really looking at it as, I don't want this person, I don't want that person. And it becomes a numbers game. So, for instance, all too often, if it's a high-profile case or a felony accusation, you might have as many as, you know, 65, 100 proposed jurors, and they're seated in order. So once you get, if it's a felony accusation, once you get 12 persons on to serve on the jury, once you get to the number 12 or 12 seated, then the rest of the people just, you know, don't get to sit on the jury is what it amounts to. But here's where actually the rubber really meets the road. You know, as we said a few months ago, it's a numbers game. And so a lot of times, you know, you ask these questions, you know, to qualify persons or disqualify persons from being on jury. So if a person is predisposed to, you know, to a particular mindset, he or she may be clever enough to be to get him or herself disqualified, or may be clever enough not to say certain things if that person really wanted to be on the jury and he or she fit, you know, within those numbers, if you will. And literally it's numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 all the way down. So if, let's say, and this is one of the problems that I always, you know, talk about with our people, we all too often want to, you know, have this premise of, well, I don't sit in judgment, only God sits in judgment. So we do these things to get ourselves off of the jury when our counterparts, white people, may very well say, okay, look, well, I know that I want to be on the jury to convict this person, or I may want to be on the jury to acquit this person, depending upon who the accused might be. They're sophisticated enough to dodge certain questions, or even on the jury questionnaire, not to answer certain questions that will raise suspicion. And so, you know, we all too often disqualify ourselves by making certain statements, putting certain statements on the jury the juror questionnaires, that which we, you know, would not be able to quote unquote follow the law, or we may already have a predisposition or prejudice, or, you know, or for or against the prosecution. And so when that happens, then the attorneys, prosecutors, or those representing the person accused of the crime, if, you know, if it's in the criminal accusation, can then, you know, make the argument that this person need not be on the jury or should be disqualified because he or she cannot follow the law, or they have a predisposition, or they have already a bias. So we disqualify ourselves when our white counterparts are sophisticated enough, even if they have that bias, they're sophisticated enough not to bring that bias to light. And that's where a lot of times you have, you know, these jurors, or the juries, excuse me, that, you know, you may have, you know, 10 white persons, 11 white persons, or even, let's say, an entire jury of white people, you know, to determine the fate of an accused black person, or even determine the fate of an accused white person who may, you know, as in the situation as with Trayvon Martin, you know, who, you know, these white persons then may determine the fate of their own, if you will. So the thing is that we have to be educated, in my opinion, when we are in the jury veneer and requested to come to jury service, we really need to be sophisticated and educated enough to know when to say something and really when not to say something, because the bottom line will be, we cannot, in my opinion, cry foul, you know, if there is an adverse ruling in a criminal accusation against someone that we loved when we did not even want to serve on the jury. You know, is not when there's no guarantee that somebody would be on the jury, but we certainly, you know, disqualify ourselves when we make, you know, these sorts of comments, and they may all be true. You know, yes, we certainly know that Allah stands in the judgment of everyone. This is true, but in the legal system, the system that we have in place in the states and the federal government, bottom line is, it's the jury of one's peers, and that is the civic duty that we have, and we should take full advantage of it. Again, because if it's an adverse ruling, it's kind of difficult then to cry foul if we disqualified ourselves from being on a potential jury.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Brother Attorney Christmas, did you want to add anything along that line? Did you?
I think he summed it up very well. I agree with all of that. For us as black people, jury service is one of the most important things that we can do. And it has always frustrated me when we attempt to get out of jury service. And since we're all attorneys, we know how difficult it would be for us to be on a jury, because most times if we get called for jury service, we're going to get struck, because most attorneys don't want other attorneys on the jury because they believe they would have too much influence over the jury. And I think he's absolutely correct when he says that when you pick a jury, it's more about the people you don't want than the people you want, because you're looking to see individuals that you think will have a bias towards your client to strike. And oftentimes what I find in the voir dire process in picking a jury is that blacks will sometimes use that as an opportunity to vent and to tell, especially in criminal cases, to tell about different bad experiences that they may or may not have had with the police, and how they can't believe the police under any circumstances. And that is going to get you struck from the jury, because what you always want to be able to say is that regardless of any type of experience that I've had, I can be fair and impartial and only be guided by the evidence that's being presented to me in this hearing. Because we all come into these situations with preconceived notions about different things. You know, whenever we look at people, you know, you make determinations about them, how they dress, how they may wear their hair, what kind of car they're driving. I mean, that's just human nature. You make determinations like that all the time. But that doesn't mean that you can't base your decision this day on the evidence that's being presented, and that you can't be fair and impartial. And we really have to do more education around that. I think he's absolutely right. You know, we really should be doing jury seminars with our people all the time, educating them on how to serve on a jury, you know, how to respond, because quite often we don't know how to respond, and that does end up in us being struck from the jury. And people that are better educated about the process and more sophisticated, as you mentioned, you know, end up getting themselves on the jury. And so we have to go in aggressively trying to get on that jury versus aggressively trying not to be picked. That needs to be our mindset every time we get a notice for jury service, that I'm really going to try my best to get on this jury. And I'm going to reiterate after every question, no matter how I answer, that doesn't mean that I cannot be fair and impartial, and I can be guided by only the evidence that's presented to me in court. And especially in these cases, these high-profile cases where you know that there's been significant media attention and there's been a significant amount of exposure on the facts of the case already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, these are excellent points, because is it important to have your peers, you know, black people on juries? You, Gerald, Attorney Christmas, you work in the city of St. Louis, I know, a lot of times, which is you have black people, you have a black prosecutor, and oftentimes the jury pools are made up large amounts of black people, but if our people aren't maybe showing up to serve on these juries, if they're not as educated as you're saying about, you know, how to fairly put themselves on juries, you know, what kind of impact have you seen in a black jurisdiction? Because, Brother Thiel, we're down here in Harris County, where oftentimes there are large pools of whites who come on, you know, for the jury veneer. And then you have to try to get some black people on the jury here. So, you know, can you all kind of talk a little bit about some specific mistakes that you're seeing people make? Because I think it's very important what you're saying.
You know, what I see specific, but when you are called, you use that opportunity to vent about all the different problems that you've had. And that is not the time to vent about issues that you may have with the justice system. I think that you have to focus in on the questions that you're being asked and only answer the question that you're being asked. A lot of times people like to elaborate and start talking about things that they were not even asked about. And you need to just listen carefully and just answer the questions that you have been asked and answer that question specifically as to what the attorney is asking you, and not, you know, volunteer additional information or, you know, say things that, like, you could never, for example, people will say, you know, I can never believe anything the police say. You know, that, those are things that will get you struck. And even though we have a majority black population in the city of St. Louis, we oftentimes do not have a large pool of black jurors. And then sometimes, a lot of times, though, you know, we will have, just because of the population, you know, we will have a pool of black jurors, but then a lot of them will get disqualified because of statements that they make.
Yeah, so, I think this is important, especially the need and the civic duty to actually serve on the jury, because a lot of times I've seen people not want to spend that type of time. You know, you need to get back to work, or you'd rather be anywhere but spending that type of hours, you know, in a case. But how important is it to have black perspectives when you're trying a case?
I think it's extremely important to have that black perspective. And it's extremely important for the blacks that make the jury to stand strong and not let them, you know, do not let other people sway you. You know, it's important if you are chosen to serve on the jury that you stand strong when you are on that jury, because that's extremely important.
See, and on that point, you know, when I'm representing, you know, in a criminal accusation, and I often tell, you know, the prospective jurors is what I come up with. What I've come up with is the juror's bill of rights. You, as a juror, as an individual juror, have the right to your own opinion. You also have the right to inform the judge if your fellow jurors are, you know, bullying you, trying to get you to change your mind, just like Brother Gerald just said. Stand your ground and don't acquiesce just because, you know, other persons in here may be on the jury. When you go back to deliberate, other persons may, you know, appear more educated, whatever the situation might be. Or, heck, sometimes they even, you know, exert their white influence, if you will, but and all too often we acquiesce to it. But as I say, you know, when I tell them, look, and I try to instill, you, as I said, the juror's bill of rights, and you as an individual must remember that regardless of what, you know, this juror says or that juror says, I believe this, and I'm going to vote this way, my understanding and interpretation of the evidence and the facts, as opposed to, well, I'm going to vote this way just, you know, to go along, to get along. The heck with that. You've got to, you know, maintain your individuality. And it sometimes it's difficult in there, you know, in those jury rooms and everything. But you have to do that, and you have to know that, look, this, we have the right to do that, that I as a juror have a right to send a note to the judge in deliberations that, you know, this is going this way or this is going that way, they're swaying this way, that way. Stand for it, and don't be bullied into, you know, voting one way when in fact you truly believe the opposite way, but you want to acquiesce to the pressures, if you will.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Good point. And for our listeners, if anyone has a question or a comment of these two attorneys, please press the #1 button and it'll get you in the host queue. Because I want to go ahead and dive into another aspect of this conversation about racism. You know, racism is the elephant in the room. And anytime you have the lynching of our brother Ahmaud Arbery, and you also have that in the case of this Rashad Robinson, who was shot 79 times, they say, exit wounds and 59 bullets in his body. So in a situation where in Ahmaud Arbery's case where the jurors were excluded, they actually, the defense was actually able to eliminate black people from the jury pool. And the part that's really interesting is that they were able to convince the judge that it wasn't about race, that they were just excluding these people based upon, not on their race. And so I think that's part of the conversation we need to have. I know, Brother Thiel, you've written a paper about how Batson versus Kentucky, which was a protector for black people to be able to keep black people on these juries, you know, because it's important. You got a white defendants, no black people on the jury, was to keep them from saying, oh, okay, these white people lynched him, and we've been lynching black people, you know, since slavery, since we brought him here, so we'll just nullify. And the same thing, I think, with our young brother, when you see him being shot that many times, where is, you know, racism is really at the root of this. So talk to me about how the exclusion of black people, the elimination of black people from jurors, and what's that about? What is that about?
Yes, ma'am. The Batson case, you know, summing it up, dealt with primarily, you know, that black persons were being excluded from serving on a jury because the thought was we were not capable of rendering fair and impartial decisions that we would, let's say if it's in a black person who was accused of the crime, we would be predisposed to you know, vote to not guilty, I guess is what it amounts to. And so the thought was then that am I blanking out? Sorry.
A little bit. You're back. Yes, sir. We hear you.
Oh, okay. And so thank you, Ben. And so the thought initially was, and we need to clarify this as well, the thought initially was that the Batson challenge, what winds up happening, just to give the listeners, if you don't know, once, let's say, you submit your selections, if you will, to the judge. You look over, you know, both sides get a chance to look at them, and the judge, you know, makes his or her ruling. Then that's
right,
when
which
you raise
is what
the
happened
issue
in
that,
Aubrey's case. Let's
right.
You know, put it in Aubrey's case. They struck the black
right.
people from the jury.
Precisely.
And the
and
judge,
then what happens,
you know, yeah. I'm
and
sorry.
Then what happens is, you then, you know, get the opportunity traditionally, and I'm saying this word traditionally, the thought was then that for the, if it's a black person who is accused, his or her counsel would then, you know, challenge the prosecutor's exclusion of those black jurors, you know, based upon, you know, racially biased and all of these different things. So, but what is actually, and so a lot of times people look at it, the traditional thought is, the Batson challenge to an excluded juror only applies to the defense, if you will. But that's not true. It applies both ways. So the prosecutor can also challenge. And not only does it apply in a criminal accusation, it also applies to civil accusations or civil trials. So you have the Batson argument both ways. The prosecutor and or the defendant can raise those challenges as in a criminal accusation, as well as the plaintiff's counsel and the defendant's counsel can similarly raise those claims in a civil matter. And okay. So this is what really has, as I've said this also, if you are predisposed as a oh dear, I tell you, oh boy.
Yeah. So, I mean, what he's saying, it's about racial bias. If you're
right.
racist, if this is your way, if you and we know, because I just want to put out here the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, in his article on the Final Call. Now, this is the same Final Call where the young man is on the cover being shot 59 times. And his article is Justifiable Homicide, Black Youth in Peril. And what he's telling us in this article is how, since we have been in America, we have been under the domination of a power that during slavery did not have to justify the murder of our fathers. They didn't have any group of people to look at facts. The slave master had the power of life and death on every black person outside the principle of justice. He says outside the principle of justice, with no regard for the life of the black male or female that was being put to death. And then he goes on to say on the next page, I'm just going to quote one sentence, to say that white supremacy reigns in American society. So, you know, he goes on to talk about Brown v. Board. He talks about how, you know, you've got this NAACP decision and the Brown versus Board of Education, but we're still looking at white supremacy reigning. So I think when you're mentioning and you're doing I really hearing what you're saying, but the listeners have to understand that the safeguard of being able to say, are you excluding black people from the jury intentionally, it does go to the root of the racist society that we live in. Brother Thiel, don't you agree? Yeah, his phone.
I totally agree.
There's no question. I agree with that.
Yes, sir. Can I agree?
Can you hear me? Oh, dear.
Yeah, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, there's no question. I mean, that is at the root of it. You'll get no argument out of me on that. No counter-argument out of that.
No, I know, because that's what you wrote about in your piece. As well. So, brother Christmas, did you want to chime in on that as well?
Yes, I agree 100% too. Race and class is really at the bottom of all issues in this country. And then the two also intersect. So it's always when you get to the crust of any of these issues, that's what it generally will boil down to, and especially in the criminal justice system. And I think that's why it's so important when you talk about prosecutors' offices have been notorious for striking black jurors. That has been a practice and still is probably a practice in many prosecutors' offices across the country. That's why it's so important to have diversity in those offices, and diversity across the system to be able to identify that when it's happening. Because sometimes, you know, when you don't have black prosecutors, you don't have black judges, white people can be blind to what other white people are doing. And I don't know necessarily if they're blind, but they don't have the same convictions or the same tenacity to go after them for the things that they're doing. And it's important that we are in these different positions so that we can attack when they are trying to misrepresent the law and strike black people from the jury in not only as Brother Theo said, in criminal cases, but in civil cases too. And you have to have people that are astute enough to pick up on that and will address it. And so it's important, you know, for us that are holding these positions that we stand strong and stand true to our people in holding these positions and don't just cave in the prosecutor's office and cave in and just do what the other prosecutors are doing. But you have to be the one that speaks up and speaks out when you see these things happening.
Yeah, no, I think you're both really making some good points because now you hit my buzzword for the week, Attorney Christmas, and we're going to come back to it. But, you know, this whole movement about diversity is very much a being thrown out there and how diversity is going to be the solution to all of our problems. And I don't necessarily believe that the outcome will be much different because, again, according to Dred Scott's case, a black man has no rights that a white man is bound to respect. And but, you know, we'll see. And because I think that the Aubrey case, when you look at the fact of how they deflected and were able to discount the racism and the racist reasons for why they were striking those black men or black people from the jury, this is something that I think we need to look at in America to say they don't want us to engage in the system at all, and they're very good at excluding us from these processes. Because Brother Thiel, you wrote in your article that there were books. Brother Thiel wrote an article about jury selection, and he talked about how in prosecutors' offices there were books that instructed them on how to exclude black people from the jury. And this was at one of the root of what Batson's case, you know, sought to give black people protections. You know, and they still
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely true. Being a former prosecutor, I know that. And having been a prosecutor, when I talk about diversity, I know the difference that you can make if you are right-minded. It's difficult being in the prosecutor's office, but you can make a difference. And it does make a difference to have black prosecutors in that office, as long as they are not drinking the Kool-Aid, you know, if they are actually enlightened and understand the struggle that we have, they can be of service in that office.
Yes, sir. No,
and
I
on that,
you.
What you were saying, Sister Pamela, is that the book, in fact, it was noted by Justice Marshall, who, you know, had the concurring opinion in Batson, is that he had stated that, you know, in part that there was an instruction book as used by the prosecutor's office in Dallas County, Texas, you know, which is obviously up there in Dallas is what it amounts to, where, you know, Justice Marshall noted in note 3 of that, of the Batson opinion, that an instruction book used by the prosecutor's office in Dallas County explicitly advised prosecutors that they conduct jury selection so as to eliminate any member of a minority group. So that's the instruction. That was the teaching. You know, now, you know, Batson was decided in 1986, but just because, you know, we look at it, that was in 86, and now it's now 2021. The thought still prevails, and much the same as, you know, the thought still prevails. You know, some people may say, well, even with respect to Dred Scott, well, Dred Scott decision was overturned. That was in 1865. But I'm sorry, I beg your pardon, 1865, yes.
Okay.
So, it was 1865. But the thought still is there, you know. So, you know, the racism and the implicit biases, that's still, you know, you can legislate, you know, against, let's say, a black and white drinking fountain. But you cannot legislate the way people are going to think and what people's morals and ideologies are going to be. I can be a racist all day long. It's not illegal to be a racist, you know. And so, you know, you can have the black and white drinking fountains, the restrooms and all of these different things. Those signs can come down. You can say that it's illegal to do this. You can't do that. You can't. But you can't legislate against the way somebody's going to think. And with that, and going right back to the Dred Scott decision, that was the thought then, and it still permeates today. The thought is there. And once the thought is there, if you don't eradicate the way people think, then you're always going to have this underlying, as Brother Christmas was saying, and of course as you, Sister Pamela, as well, you're always going to have the GERD and the underlying of racism in darn near every aspect of society.
Yeah, yeah. And act accordingly, because eradicating the way people think, the racism, how they, the genocidal mindset of, you know, some people against black people. I won't say all white people, but we know the teachings. And so, you know, coming to the understanding that there is a lack of accountability, just, you know, we're talking about a ruling in 1857, but how much change has really happened since that time when you have a young man being shot 57 times and he, you know, that's just ridiculous. Brother Gerald, because I want to take it out of like an office, a prosecutor's office or a jury selection, because there's so many facets of the legal system. Did want to just say that in another case, this Rittenhouse case, where there's another trial going on where a young white boy killed some people. But in that particular jury, there was a white man actually making racist jokes who was dismissed from the jury, and I think it's so important to the nature of this white man's jokes was that, we, you know, kind of gave you the understanding that they like to cause the death of black people, and that he was joking about the death of our brother Jacob Blake, or the shooting of Jacob Blake, in terms of how white people really feel about us and the racism. So that's why I chose the subject Dred Scott and the citizenship issue, because, you know, as we know, in Dred Scott, he was a black man who was a free black man. But then when he moved into the state of Missouri, he and Missouri was a slave. And so then he took on the status of the state that he lived in, regardless of the fact that he had been freed. And so that case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and we have the infamous ruling of Justice Taney, who said black man doesn't have any rights that a white man is bound to respect. And he also went into the fact of denying that there was even any citizenship rights due to black people. And so when we're looking at the time we're living in now, where there's this denial of speech rights going on. We've got this wanton police brutality going on where people are being killed instead of being apprehended, supposedly, and taken into trial. You know, we've got all these denials of rights. We've got this denial of our rights to our own bodies, you know, where now they're mandating that people take shots, take vaccines. You know, we see the difference between how Kyrie Irving is treated versus whatever the other white player who, you know, now Aaron Rodgers, right. And so we're seeing what I think is the handwriting on the wall, that we want to also take out the courtroom, but by giving examples of what we see in the courtroom. So there's a lack of accountability that we just can't seem to get past with these laws and this legal system where, again, doesn't seem like that a black man has any rights that a white man, it feels like he's bound to respect.
Right, and you see, this is another thing that I've also been saying, too. You know, we've been socialized so much in this country, you know, and when I say we, you know, people who live in this country, black and white, you know, that to the point of when we refer to Africa, we refer to it or you know, as a third world country. You know, I know Africa is a continent, but, you know, we're talking about, you know, countries in Africa. And so we even buy into that third world, you know. Mm. So when we use those phrases and it's so ingrained in us, well, we are putting ourselves in a subordinate and in an inferior context. Because we buy into that.
Mm.
And so,
yes,
you know, and as you were just saying, you know, with Aaron Rodgers, you know, you take Aaron Rodgers versus Kyrie Irving. Now, I listen to, you know, some sports radio and I watch ESPN. And, yeah, Aaron Rodgers is taking flack. But he's not really taking the flack for not being vaccinated. And correct me if I'm wrong, you know, but he's really taking the flack for, I guess, what, lying or using the phrase he was immunized, I think is the phrase. Whereas Kyrie Irving is being villainized for not taking the vaccine. Well, both haven't taken the vaccine. We have to now look at what is and open our eyes. You know, what's that phrase that I like to use? There are none so blind than those who refuse to see. Open your eyes and see the clear distinction. What's good for the goose is good for the gander, if you will. Kyrie Irving, from my understanding, made it very clear, look, I'm not vaccinated. I'm not taking the vaccine. Fair enough. But he's villainized for that. Aaron Rodgers is not villain. Aaron Rodgers is villainized or criticized because he lied, but they're not even looking at the point that he's unvaccinated. So, okay, well, what's the difference here, people? The difference is what people say is that the white privilege. Yeah, he's still being, you know, criticized, but not in the same vein as, let's say, Kyrie Irving. So, again, people, open your eyes and see there is a clear distinction as the treatment, and we're always going to deal with that, and sometimes we play right into it. We, you know, our black, you know, we play right into it, which sorts, you know, which takes away the strength of the argument.
Yes, sir.
I think unfortunately, most times we do play too often into it, and that's the problem. We need to open our eyes up and see these issues for what they really are. And you're absolutely right about the difference in the treatment that, you know, Kyrie is being villainized, and he's being villainized by black people along with white people. You know, Charles Barkley came down hard on him. I think Roland Martin came down hard on him. Also, if I'm not mistaken, oftentimes the people who are put in the position to give information or to address the community as a whole will be the ones that have their eyes closed and not addressing these issues the way they should be for our people. And we see that quite often. We see it playing out, you know, right now in the Congress. When we talk about you know, you have Senator Manchin and Sinema holding up legislation that we know will be beneficial to our people, and that's not even enough. But yet the Black Caucus has at least 60 members, at least 20 of them are in solidly black districts that can't be touched. They can hold up any piece of legislation they want to. Right now, we don't have any reason not to blow this system up because it's not working for us. So there are many things that the caucus could be standing on right now and saying, if we don't get it, nobody gets it. And they have the power to do that. And they don't exercise that power. You know, recently in that last vote, the progressives, the five progressives, and you know, Cori Bush being our congresswoman from St. Louis, did vote no. And I was proud to see her vote no. But we need more people in leadership to stand up. And they have the perfect opportunity to stand up. And that would send a message to our entire race and the entire world, actually, if the Congressional Black Caucus would stand up.
Yes, sir. That's an excellent point. Because, as, you know, it's like we say, the realization that we are free and that we don't have to live in the shadow of Dred Scott where we don't have rights of citizenship. It's like our people, we walk into that and we accept that role, because when you look at Aaron Rodgers, his community is supporting him. His community is saying that he has a right to have a mind, you know, of his own. His community is saying that he has the right to make his own decisions and that he has constitutional rights, you know, that he can protect. And so we have to find better ways to express that. Kyrie Irving, our brother, he has the same rights, and we have to exercise our own right to freedom. We had a show a couple of weeks ago where we talked about politics and the Justice Party and separation as an agenda, because, again, all too often, I'm not sure that this system is ever going to yield from their racist beliefs that a black man has no rights that a white man is bound to respect. And so we got to look at other options. That, you know, it's a roundtable discussion, and so I do appreciate whatever, you know, what we're all saying in terms of how to get some accountability in this system. You know, Attorney Christmas, you're from Ferguson, or you're from St. Louis, which everybody knows is a suburb of Ferguson, you know what I mean, suburb of Ferguson's just a suburb of St. Louis. But recently there's a documentary on PBS called Ferguson Rising, and they kind of went through what happened with our brother Michael Brown. And one of the things that stuck out with me, and I think we're seeing it with our young brother Aubrey's death, and certainly the sister whose son was shot 59 times, the tremendous loss and pain and grief these families are carrying with them because of the murders of their children, and there's nobody being held accountable for this. You know, even with the accountability sometimes with the Congress, you know, are they holding accountable the reports of people dying from these shots? You know, are we having a conversation about it? But, again, I'm just saying, you know, accountability is certainly an issue, and it's kind of like, how do we use our collective minds to get some – making our own communities decent and safe places to live for us. So,
you know, it goes back to what Brother Theo said about opening your eyes, and we are very disappointed in the lack of accountability in the killing of Michael Brown, especially when we elected overwhelmingly the black community. You know, over 90% of blacks in St. Louis County voted for Wesley Bell, a black prosecutor in St. Louis County. And we were, when he came forth with the decision that he was not going to charge Darren Wilson in the death of Michael Brown, and the way he handled that was done very poorly. And it opened up a new wound, and it's still an issue, you know, that Darren Wilson has not been prosecuted. And then for Wesley Bell to say that he felt that he could not prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. That's not even his burden. His burden is probable cause to issue charges as a prosecutor, and then it'll be a jury to determine whether or not he proved his case beyond a reasonable doubt. But in order for him to bring charges, he just needs probable cause, and that was more than enough probable cause to charge Darren Wilson with the death of Michael Brown. And then it was a small civil payout on the Michael Brown case too. And so, you know, all the way around, it's just been hurtful and damaging to not only the black community, but to the Brown family especially.
Yeah, that's That's interesting. And I think one of the issues with that documentary was that it sought to show this whole diverse racial conclusion that has come as a result, you know. And I think, to me, because I'm also from that area, I think that not much has changed. The black people in St. Louis are young people who are suffering, that there's not a lot of accountability to the needs of the community, of the black young people, as well as the fact that when we look at the total failure and breakdown that existed, that was preceded Ferguson and the outrage, because those young people through that whole policing system, the ticketing system, you know, the oppressive system, and just taking the money and throwing these young people in jail. I mean, it was an apartheid there. So that, I think the focus needs to be on, you know, what can be done and what black people need to do when you see that these type of systems really do exist in America. But I want to go ahead and take a caller. We have a caller who has a question or a comment. Let me open up her mic. Yes. Welcome to A Time for Justice. Yes, 602, area code 602. Do you have a question or a comment?
Can you hear me now, sister?
I can hear you now. Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, okay. I'm having trouble with my headset. But, you know, I read one of my favorite authors, and I'd like to, you know, give all of you all the greetings, and it's a wonderful show. One of my favorite authors is this guy called Michael Collins Piper, and what got me interested in him really was he referred to The Secret Relationship as a landmark work. And when you have a white boy saying that about that book, you know, it made me sit up and take notice of him. But he did this book. He did many, but the one that was phenomenal is called The Judas Goat. And he talked about how these politicians are bought and paid for right from the beginning. And Cynthia McKinney does a lecture on what happened to her, and as an honest politician, how they ran her out of the Congress, you know. And we kind of know a little of her story, but she tells the rest. But we as black people got to stop putting our hopes on these politicians when they're going into a corrupt system, that they can't do anything for us in this system. So we're spitting in the wind, you know, and as Dr. Claude Anderson says, our voting power ends when the poll closes. You know, that's it. You don't hear nothing about, you know, black folks not voting, black folks saying anything now, and Biden is in there. Now all they have to do is complain about what he ain't doing. Well, you knew he wasn't going to do nothing in the first place. But you want to keep hope alive to keep you from doing anything. So, you know, it's just exasperating, but we know that the teachings of Honorable Elijah Muhammad, his program is the only program that people who know what's up is looking at.
Yes, ma'am. All right then, Sister Marguerite. Well, yeah, I certainly agree with you, and thank you so much for your comments. And thank you for calling and being a real, loyal listener. We really do appreciate you and your comments.
Praise be to Allah.
Yes, ma'am. Praise be to Allah. Assalamu alaikum.
Walaikum salam.
Yeah. The roundtable discussion is still going on. I thank these brothers. They're taking their time out of their busy law practices and trying to serve the community. And this is what it's all about. Attorney Christmas, why don't you give us some way that any listeners who want to talk to you out of St. Louis, Missouri, how can they get in touch with you and your law office?
Yeah, I'll give them that. But I quickly wanted to add one other point about that, about the Rittenhouse case, where the judge ruled that the people who were killed could not be called victims. They could be called rioters or looters, but not called victims. And I think we have to pay real close attention to that. I've never heard of such, you know, and I probably would have just mistried that case right then and there in my thinking in dealing with that. I couldn't go forward with a judge making that kind of a ruling where these people have been killed and you cannot call them victims. They're nothing but that's the only thing you can call them is victims. It seems like he is trying to set up a precedent. If you are protesting, then it's all right to kill you because you can't be acknowledged as a victim, which is insane. It is completely insane for him to come to that conclusion and for them to go along with it, I think, is insane too. But if you need to reach me in the St. Louis area or you have an issue in Missouri and maybe I can't help you, but I could refer you to someone else who can, you can reach me at area code 314-588-7105. Again, that's area code 314-588-7105. Thank you for allowing me to do this.
Yes, sir. And don't go anywhere. I really appreciate what you just said. Okay. Yeah, because, I mean, Attorney Christmas, like I say, he does a lot of personal injury cases. He's actually tried cases of police brutality where the victims have been, you know, actually murdered or injured severely, as well as being a great criminal defense attorney. So I did appreciate you saying that, as well as you, Brother Athiel. Tell our listeners how they can contact you as well here in Houston.
Sure, and I certainly will. You know, anyone can reach me at my direct line, 713-807-8167. We're all around the state of Texas. And so, you know, any, you know, issues of police brutality, discrimination, if you're accused of a crime, you know, we're ready there to help is what it amounts to and represent, you know, your concerns. And, you know, as I wanted to comment also on what Brother Christmas just said also, how the judge up there, you know, in Rittenhouse case stated, you know, that you're not going to call them victims. Well, I have a big problem with that too. See, it's again, you know, as I may have mentioned one time before, word association. You know, if you depict somebody as a rioter, just as Brother Christmas was intimating, that some kind of way, then you're setting yourself up. It's okay to you to lose your life, but if you're a victim, you know, now I have sympathy for a victim, but I don't have sympathy for the rioter. And so now, you know, making that comment, you now are also now putting in people's minds, just as Brother Christmas was intimating, it's all right to kill for the rioter to lose his life. And that's what we'll focus on. This person was a rioter. But if, and so we're not going to use the word victim because a victim doesn't have the right to have his life taken, but a rioter does. You know, so it's this word association thing, these subtle uses of words to trigger emotion in people. You know, it's like how we say, Sister Pamela, and some of our listeners have heard, you know, if a white person, you know, goes on a shooting spree, the white person is considered he has emotional problems. If a black person does it, oh, he's an animal or a savage. If a person of Arab descent does it, he's a terrorist. You see, word association. And as long as we continue to play into that and listen to that and have those things in our minds, well, we're always going to then, you know, look at those words and look at those characterizations of people to have either sympathy or outright disdain for the person, depending upon the label that is associated with that person. And so as Brother Christmas was saying, that the judge said, victim versus rioter. Come on now, look at the word association there. I'm not going to have any sympathy for the rioter, but I'll have all kinds of sympathy for the victim. They're the same thing, in my opinion.
No, you're right. And if the Final Call newspaper, the same November 9th edition of the Final Call newspaper, the first article in it is called History of White Newspaper. And so this particular article talks about the usage of newspapers going back to our time in slavery, back to our, you know, the early 1800s, where black people were referred to as brutes and fiends and bad Negroes. And Negroes across the South were greeted, you know, readers with all kinds of caricatures. And so that article on the Final Call, it really talks about how that type of word association, if you will, is geared to cause hatred and harm and cast negative lights on black people. This is how it's been used historically. So now we're seeing it used again, and that's why this conversation I think is so important when we're looking at Dred Scott being the root where the true knowledge of how they feel about, especially who you're denying rights to. You're denying constitutional rights. It's, you know, best known for us as black people, we've been denied those rights, those, you know, but now we're seeing it being used, and the motive is clear. The intent, as you all are saying, is clear. Can we talk to our listeners about how intent is sometimes, you know, how we have to look for intent in the law, in cases, when you're trying to actually prove that someone intentionally injured someone, and maybe that race was an animus, or that it's an intentional crime. Give the listeners some of that legal knowledge that we see in these cases.
In most all the criminal cases that we deal with, you know, intent is very important, because you know the state is trying to show that, you know, this was an intentional act, and especially when you talk about homicides and murder charges, you know, you're really looking at whether or not this was, you know, intentional, deliberate, was it accidental. And when you look at that Rittenhouse case, you know, he was intentionally gunning people down. And
that's right.
Just the thought that you cannot call these people victims is insane, as I said. And it's that word association. And we do have to be very cognizant of that word association. And a lot of times, you know, too much, and we see it often here in St. Louis, too much negativity is associated with us intentionally. And, you know, our children at a very young age are being fed a lot of negative word association, a lot of negative marketing is being promoted to our children day in and day out on a regular basis in, you know, several media forms, and radio and television and in social media.
Yes, sir. That's right. You know, and that article in the Final Call, the specific wording is that the news was used to incite racial terror and falsely accuse black people of crime. So, again, this whole thing about the deception of what is the intention of what's being done, if we keep in mind that historically the intention, you know, has been that black people don't have rights, that white people don't respect rights, this is kind of where what I wanted to draw some legal argument tonight, because it even goes into critical race theory as an issue, and I just want to throw that out there. Because even when you look at cases like Dred Scott, where you see the racial animus being talked about in the courts, you see them talk about how black people don't have rights, how they don't have citizenship rights, and it's right there in black and white. Well, they want to erase that knowledge from our psyche. Have y'all noticed that? Because then how can we infer, you know, if I don't know my history, then I'm looking at like, oh, well, what is their intention? Well, you know their history. you know what I'm saying? You know they have a history. And sometimes, Attorney Christmas, you know how in some of those cases where people had prior acts of bad acts, you know, prior similar acts, you say, well, if you did it then, you're doing it now. And I can draw some kind of legal argument on that. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. And that happens quite often. And it's interesting that you brought up critical race theory, because the Confederates, then that's what I call them, not Republicans. You have to call them Confederates because that's what they are. They want to overthrow the country. We're going to be running on in the next election cycles coming up because they saw how they were able to use that in Virginia. And it's the same analogy with not wanting, making it illegal to teach black people to read. Because if you can read, you can't be a slave. And if you know your history and you know the history of how you arrived here in this country, then you're going to be in a much better position to fight and to stand up and to be strong. And they don't want that to happen. And that's why they are using this critical race theory as a way to rally and form this white unity. Because to me, when you talk about bipartisanship, all you're talking about is trying to maintain white unity at the expense of everybody else that's not white, and especially at the expense of black people.
But you do have, I think, always in law, you know, you've always had the liberal, if that's what the name is. I find them often in the child welfare system, who profess that they want to do such good, and the policies and practices, you know, like, for example, in the Clinton administration, you know, we know that more people went to jail, you know, the actual probation that led to the prison pipeline, the crack cocaine sentencing, under these theories trying to do good. And so I think, you know, for us as a people, we have to look at our interests is what I think. And so you see that some of the Republicans are the ones who file some of the lawsuits to challenge some of these violations of constitutional rights when you have these mandates. And many of our people are going to be the ones who are at risk of losing jobs in the federal government and state government. And again, are our this other side, are they speaking up in support of the people? So, you know, no permanent friends, no, what do they call it when we got to look at our own self-interest, and even states, you know, you've got people talking about looking at certain states and what states may be favorable to some of your interests. So it's a time like we've never seen, I think, before. You know, Attorney Christmas, I agree, but I think we're looking at a people who have been denied constitutional and citizenship rights, perhaps going back even before Dred Scott's decision that was made, and I certainly would not like to see that taken from the books. But I also don't want to keep accountability that I'm looking for. I believe that we're going to have to get it ourselves. You know, we're going to have to make our own communities decent and safe places to live because it's, you know, it's just no change. It's like whoever is in, doesn't matter sometimes. So, you know, these are the type of conversations, though, that I think is so important that we have in the legal community because conversations are definitely important. And talking to our people about some of this hidden history that we see in these court decisions, that's another something that I wanted to bring out tonight. You know, you oftentimes talk about Attorney Christmas, how the grand jury process is sometimes, I guess, a secret. And in secret, you know, so many decisions are made, and we never know what's really on the table until we're just handed, well, this is the outcome. And oftentimes that's not a fair procedure. And, you know, this is something that I think is really important, because I did bring up the fact in our talking points that, you know, when the truth is hidden, and this was really going back to the jury selection issue again, when the truth is hidden by, like we see the defendant's attorneys in Aubrey's case, and they're able to strike all these black jurors, and then they're able to tell the judge with a straight face that they didn't do it because of race, because now the truth is hidden, you know, and I think even the judge said, well, you know, the judge said, you know, the case could proceed, but I don't even think he was as convinced, you know, that maybe there wasn't some racial bias, but you know, this is the system that we're faced with here, and again, is, you know, we don't see white people getting shot 59 times. We just don't see it. And this young man who was shot, he supposedly had schizophrenia. He had some history or some thought. So his mental health problem, and this is how the lack of accountability that we're still dealing with. You know,
yeah, so many of these cases have mental health issues. That's not uncommon, that we have people in our community that are gunned down that have mental health issues.
Mm. Yes, sir. Yes,
and I
sir.
Think we do have to look at that. And, you know, if you live in states where the judges are elected, we have to pay attention to these rulings, and when these judges are not ruling in our favor, then we need to go to the ballot box and eliminate them from being on the bench. When you are in jurisdictions that have that opportunity to do that, and even when we look at now at, you know, at the Supreme Court, Justice Barrett should be retiring now, while we had an opportunity to. We have a Democratic president in that can, you know, maybe put somebody, a black woman, on the court. You know, it really should have happened under Obama's term. You know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg should have retired in Obama's first term, because you have to be, and we have to be strategic, you know, in working in this system that we have to try to work, have it work as best we can, to get the justice results that we want to see. And the fact that Trump could put those three appointees on the court in one term, we see the impact of that, and him loading up the federal bench, you see the impact of that. And so when we have opportunity to now put justices on the Supreme Court and at the federal level, we need to be pushing for that to get, you know, our people in these positions.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, if I may, I just want to say, you know, this is a big argument, because right now the checks and balances that even exist in the Constitution seem to have been circumvented, because now Biden is just issuing mandates. You know, he's not going through the Congress. This is not, you know, the country of the people, for the people. These are just some people trying to tell us now what it is to do. And this is just unheard of. People, you know, these Republicans or governors or whoever they are actually filing lawsuits to get some check and balance system. It's almost like, you know, now the poor or people who aren't in control right now are being treated as if black people, who have always been denied our 13th Amendment rights, you know, we're treated as slaves. We, you know, put in prisons and unjustly surveilled and no probable cause and, you know, suppression of speech is now such a big issue, and this is under a quote-unquote, you know, Democrat president. So I think we're looking and examining how to get out of this Dred Scott mentality of these people don't want to respect our rights under the law, and how do we make that happen? Now, we're down to like the 4 minutes, and I want to say, as lawyers always, you all are the ones, we are the ones that go into these courts every day, and we do fight hard to get the best outcomes with the constraints that we have. And so we certainly always respect our black lawyers who respect us. And these two lawyers here are fine attorneys who fight for the rights of the poor, the oppressed, you know, and are just very, have great integrity. So, in this conversation and looking at Dred Scott and looking at the history, you know, and putting together pieces to the puzzle, that's just really what we're doing and trying to explain to our people some of the constraints that we see in the court and what supposedly is the law and how it's sometimes used very deceptively. So I want to give Brother Thiel an opportunity to close out and make his statement. I know you had something to say, Brother Thiel.
Yes, ma'am. What I wanted to say was, you know, that, see, again, you know, people, as we say, and I'm saying this to everybody, you know, not only our, you know, black audience, but everybody, you know, just look and listen. Because, you know, one thing that, you know, some of our listeners may, you know, not remember, but one thing that always comes to mind is how white people are. Remember when O.J. was found not guilty? The cry in the country then was, the law needs to be changed. I mean, that was the biggest cry. Something's wrong with the justice system. But that's what we've been saying for decades.
Yeah.
You see, so the point is, when the decision is not in white people's favor, it's the justice system then needs to be changed. But if he was found guilty, you know, everything. I remember some years ago when you had the Duke lacrosse players down in Durham, North Carolina, I believe it was. They were accused of rape of, you know, these black women. Well, as I recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, they weren't indicted. And if I'm remembering all of the hullabaloo around that was that they weren't indicted and the system or the justice system worked fairly.
Mm.
But justice system was unfair with respect to O.J. Simpson's verdict. Now, whether or not O.J. Simpson
yes,
did it or not, I have no – that's not the argument.
Yeah.
And but
Brother
the position
Thiel, you know
is,
what? We're running out of time. I'm sorry. We're
right,
down
no,
to
right. But the position.
Minute.
So my
yes,
point,
sir.
All of that is, people pay attention and don't fall for the okie doke. Again, there are none so blind than those who refuse to see. Take the blinders off.
That's right. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So ultimately, we want, you know, full and complete freedom. And, you know, we want on a time for justice. You know, we at least want the truth. We want to be able to talk about it. And I think that's what we did tonight. I thank you so much, both of you all, for coming on the show. And thank you, listeners, for coming and listening to A Time for Justice. And you can hear previous shows in the archive. I'd like to thank Sister Samaya, who is the producer of this show. She helps, and I would like to thank Sister Dr. Ava Muhammad, who hosts her show, The Elevated Places, on Thursday at 7 p.m. I'd like to thank the rest of the Elevated Places team, and I would like to thank you all once again for listening and ask that you tune in next week for more informative discussions. Assalamu alaikum.